sure you can hold on to that energy without losing it and giving it to you.
No, no, not that we are confused about what's what and how we should use it. I'll talk about effortless effort.
Seva is the effortless ultimate. Seva is Sanskrit for devotional service. Every action must be dedicated to the service of the Lord as the creation around you. In a fatigue state. Now, you don't have time to do this, and you don't have to work correspond to conditions of the mind, and you don't pressure yourself. Now, if you're going to do something, you don't put your own status and say, oh, this is not my job, but somebody else did it. But then there is something to be done. There's some effort to explain, do it. And don't do it because it is yours, but it's not yours to be done. Perform it as an action in the universe. In fact, whose house is this all? Whose creation is it? It's your father's. We are the children, and if we don't take care of it, who's going to take care of it? Are we going to pass the buck on our brothers?
They know that there's someone else that has to teach you a certain lesson, either from karmic ties that the two of you have and all, but the Satguru, that is the last one in the chain, the last link in the chain that attaches you to God. And that one must be a saint or a master through the fifth realm in order to be able to do that properly, because the master can only take you as far as he himself can go in each realm. And this doesn't mean that, as Adana says, God is truly the master, and is the consciousness, the master consciousness working through all. The college professor isn't any better than the kindergarten teacher as far as the learning process is concerned. You need the different ones at the different levels. And, but that one you have to find that can, that exhibits all the qualities of what is said of a Satguru, the one that has demonstrated that he can go through all these realms and do that. And as far as I'm concerned, I've had a number of guru masters or master gurus, but the Satguru. Now, there's always at least one Satguru in physical incarnation in the world. Times of great stress, there are more than one, and there are more than one now. Now, there are those who are as fully qualified spiritually, but to them, it hasn't been given the office of doing this, the initiation that does this, or the procedure that does this. Just like there are many people, many men probably fully qualified to be president of the United States as far as ability is concerned, but only one can occupy that position at a time, and only one has the right of the power inherent in that office. The others help in other ways, just like the men of ability and so on all work in the government, others do, and sustain the government, and they're needed. As far as the people are concerned, they do just as much good, possibly, as the president. But he's the one that's there in that office. And there are certain ones that are called to fulfill those duties and to work outwardly with people. And you have to seek and search through reading, through studying, through listening, you know, seeking and so on, to find the one that is for you. Like Jesus said, the shepherd knows his sheep and the sheep know the shepherd's voice. This is true. The physical body of a master, his parentage, his environment, see the country in which he lives, you know, the community and area, and what that physical body goes through or experiences during a lifetime is all determined by the collective karma of his disciples. That is, when he is a master where he has no more karma, but is coming to. All right. Some masters still have some karma. They are becoming ascended masters. They work out a last bit of karma. See, and they reach that position or condition, should I say, you know, if they're through with their karma and they're working to help others, then they have no more karma. Now then, but even that type of master, it's known that he will achieve that during that lifetime. But we'll just say even a master that comes born with no karma, that he is sent back with the will of God to help others. There has to be some type of karma to bring him into the earth, see, into the physical plane. And that's the collective karma of the souls that he's coming to help. Now, is that... Mm-hmm. Do it?
When Jesus went to see John the Baptist, he said, "There is no man born of woman greater than John, who is Elijah that has come. He was not born by the will of the flesh, that is, no craving or desire or unfulfilled thought pattern within the structure of John, who was Elijah in the past life, triggered his rebirth. Nor was he born by the will of his parents. They couldn't crave a John the Baptist because they didn't know what one would look like."
Well, they were way, the wife was way past childbearing age. He was born.
But he was born by the will of the Lord, strictly that he was returning to fulfill God's plan and accepting the karmic conditions of those people who he would be committed to. Then, when he came into the body, he baptized by water those people who he called upon to repent, accepting them as his responsibility. But then he knew he was going to go out of the body, and this declaration of Jesus concerning John's heritage and background is giving credence to John as a divine incarnate, as the living master of the time. John now, who is going to leave the body, must give credence of this quality, his lineage, and passing it on. So he said, "I baptized by water, not one after me whose shoes I'm not even worthy to unlatch. He baptized by spirit." This is giving credence now to accept Jesus. Otherwise nobody will accept Jesus. So one man recognizes the other man and lays the foundation for the untainted heritage, the unpolluted heritage of the Spirit. And then that individual now gets credence of carrying over this heritage and lineage. So John perceived his own death, he needs to die. He died a horrible death too. He was beheaded. But before it occurred, he was already establishing spiritual lineage. Now, nobody can elect the master because this is something that is transferred. Now, in a previous life, these two same men existed as disciples and students. John was Elijah in the past life, and he had a student called Elijah. Or Elias, is that it?
Well, Elijah is a Greek name for Elijah. Elisha was the disciple.
Elisha.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Just forget Elias. It was Elijah and Elisha.
Elisha said to his teacher in the previous life, this is Jesus in this present life, and this is John the Baptist, he said, "Why don't you give me a double portion of your spirit?" Meaning, why don't you give me cosmic consciousness? And the teacher said, you ask a hard thing, which means you're asking for something without earning it. You want something for nothing. There's no something for nothing in this universe. So he imposes a restriction on the transference. He says, if you see me before I go or leave this frame, the mantle is yours, the mantle is yours, this spiritual unfoldment is yours. I will transfer it to you with all the power that goes with it. Providing if you see me before I go.
When I go?
Right.
Before I'm in consciousness.
Right, but if you see me before or I go, imposes quite a condition on the man, because the man can't even go to the bathroom. He can't eat and keep his mind in the lower base. He's got to keep his mind up there all the time, and he doesn't know when the teacher's going to go out of the body. You see, he places such an intense discipline on the man, because the man wants something for nothing, and he didn't spend all that time to be totally concentrated. So the teacher really placed him through the paces. But it was granted to him. In the next incarnation, the roles had to be reversed. The teacher came back by the grace of God, acting the role of John, and the student came back to Jesus now to act out the role, where the student must take up the responsibility of the karma of the world that he's involved in, or those disciples that are going to be drawn to him. So John had certain disciples who were drawn to him while he was in the body, and Jesus came back again, and the two had to make contact, and then Jesus had to take up the responsibility of going on. Because even Jesus was not born by his own desires. He was not born by the desires of his parents. He too was born by the will of the Lord. So the karma of the disciples to whom he would be involved with, they would determine how long he stayed in the body. They would determine how he will die. This is what the thing is all about.
And here, but when you begin to understand it, that it, we, in a sense, see, are so intimately related with the Masters that our thoughts, our feelings, everything like that determine things that they go through. This begins to kind of shake you up. You begin to examine your actions even a lot more closely, even than when you think, you know, of your own, what is going to happen to you. The love begins to grow in you for the Master, just like, well, for someone else you love, you know, you think, how do my actions affect that person? You begin to realize how intimately, truly, we are all related. And to look at one another and realize, there's my brother, there's my sister. There, how close God is to me. See, and how wonderfully God is relating to me. And these others with whom I come into contact, with whom I love. And you just, it's just every person that you look at then, see, it's just multiplied that much more. That much more wonderful.
In speaking of the Sadguru or the Sadguru or Sadguru,
S-A-T.
Is that the correct? Speak of possibly signs or some sort. I mean, I don't. You know, this is very confusing to me, just because, you know, it's also new anyway. But there are obviously different levels of masters, and this would be the highest level of master. Would there be anything that...
No, you know, it's the last person who would finally release you from the bondage or the attachment to the doer. Now you're going to meet many other individuals. What guru means to lift up the dispeller of darkness, the one who removes the desire levels in your consciousness. But there's only one who finally release you from the last desire to really fit him back in his consciousness. Now, you couldn't know him because you may be at the cafeteria of the signs of the soul, and then you're shopping around guru shopping. Here we have a curry guru and tomato guru, all kind of gurus. But somehow you walk in this cafeteria, and of all the gurus you're looking, one of them seems to ring a bell in you. You know why? You may not be the nicest one in the package, but somehow whatever he's saying, it may seem so simple, so ordinary, yet twing, something inside that that's the one who's going to finally clean up the last vestige of your thought pattern. And you seem to gravitate to him. Well, I came into the spiritual studies way back in the time of Yogananda, when Yogananda was alive. I never saw Yogananda in the body because I asked him to come there to study. He said, don't come and see my body, stay where you are and meditate. Now he was a living master. And later on, people who met Yogananda, met some of the people there in SRF, they heard that Yogananda was asked by one of the monks there to bring me there to work and study and help. And he told the brother, or the monk, what is he going to do here? Look at the palm tree. He's doing the work where he is. All right. They said, he told this fellow three times, and the last 2 days before he died, he told him the same thing, gave him the same answer for the same question. So this brother, his name is Krinanda, he was determined now to see who is this man that Yogananda didn't want to see. In 1952, this was from Yogananda Pasri, and in 1955, they met. And when he met, he said to him, I can see why the master didn't want you to come. He said, you've already worked out all the problems of the spiritual thing right there in the world of people, where he was struggling with in the ashram. And in this incarnation, he was destined to be a monk, and in this incarnation, I was destined to be a Mahajan. Our paths went two different ways, but the problems were all resolved in two different approaches. Well, Master had passed under the body, and I never really got farther than where I could have gone to see him in the physical frame. And to carry me on further in my growth, these were some of the things he told me when he was alive. Do not come and see my body. Do not go to India. The best of India will come to you. These three things he specifically laid out when I was in correspondence with him and studying. Now, any person in my situation would make every attempt to go, regardless he was told these things, you see? But the true test of a disciple is obedience. No matter if the person is a guru or not a guru, we don't even know what will be the result until you obey. I got money, I was even offered money to go to see him in America. I was living in Canada at the time. And every time I got ready to buy the ticket, something came along, I had to spend the money. It was always the funniest thing. Even those who were offering the money, something happened to their car or breakdown, they had to go spend it. So I never got to go to America to see him. The second thing was, don't go to India. I was pondering in my mind the time to go to India to become a Swami, Udrani Swami, or I never got the chance to go to India. Yet I was made a Swami in this country without even asking for it. My wife too was made Swami, and she'll tell you how it happened. But the third thing was, the best of India came to me. Everybody had heard of Master Charanasinghe and different masters, Sai Baba, and everybody was going to India. And years before, when Master Charanasinghe came to this country for the first time, I really saw his picture, but I couldn't see him at the time. I was on the West Coast, and he was traveling across to the East Coast. So we never crossed each other's paths, but we never ran into each other. Years after, in 1969, he was going to have his world trip, you know, go all over the world. Now, according to his laid out plans, he was not going to pass through Dallas, Texas. There's no way possible in his itinerary he was ever going to come to Dallas, Texas. I had encouraged my wife to go even to Mexico so he had a chance to see it. Then one of the fellows who was going to fly the plane back from India to the States was a friend of ours. He is going to fly the plane back, and that very same week when they're flying the plane, they had a thing in among the pilots is called slow down. That means playing for more time for more money. So they had to reroute these planes, and where does it reroute itself from? Via Dallas, Texas. And he's going to be in Dallas, Texas for 45 minutes. That was enough time to see the man, right? So we had a large group there, and he waited, and when he came in the room, there he was. I said, in that brief 45 minutes, I got all I needed to get, but I couldn't handle. I spent 40 years or 45 years sitting there with him, because that is how it works. So you see, obedience is the first rule, grace is the whole thing is grace. All right? But this was told to me in 1948. Look how long it took for it to materialize. Yogananda passed away in 52. Anand Swami initiated both of us in 69. And Master Charan Singh came in 70. And in the meantime, I'd encountered Sai Baba all 3 years before, and many other teachers before.
Chidananda.
All of these great Swamis are all dear blessings and lift me up in consciousness. In fact, I got many inexplicable with them. But they were not the one who would finally give me what you call a corkscrew in my brain, you know. The one who came along and without even asking, just applied the pressure to the brain, that's all. So you see, we never know who the person is. It's better to be ready and attuned, and then an individual comes on your heart to tell you, bingo.
How many of you know Satchinananda? Well, he was in Dallas. He gave an example that I think it's a wonderful. I was telling that, you know, we all want to get God consciousness right now, you know. He was talking about this girl that he was trying to explain this to, but you just can't always get it that way. I let it grow on you. And he said, well, look, he said, that's like this. He said, I guess this is the way I can explain it the best. He said, here was this little girl that mother had just had a little baby brother, see, and they were, you know, showing her the baby and how wonderful and letting her touch the baby and help mother by bringing the doctor, you know, all of this. And he said, the little girl said, oh, mommy, this is so wonderful, you know, I want a baby. And he said, that's just what it's like when you all come out and say you want God consciousness. He said, just like the mother has said to this little girl, and darling, there's got to be a few years, you know, you're not quite as big as mother is, you know, you've got to grow a little bit more. And there's going to be somebody else involved in this process, you know, and so on and on. We gradually try to explain. He said, that's what we try to do here. You just can't be in instant God consciousness any more than that little girl can be instant mommy. there ain't no way. You've got to come into this.
And God is not going to forsake you, that's for sure, because when I sat down in front of Master Charan Singh, many things opened for me to make me realize that that was not the first time. That this leader was my first incarnation, that one encountering the cosmic bliss. The cosmic presence in human form. You all have incarnations. They're being exposed to them. And when that condition comes in, you know what it's like. So what is interesting, he said, Satchinananda, my wife met him Everybody wanted me to meet him. And there's always something going on that he never could meet. And finally, I came back from Richmond in March. On my way back through Dallas, I said, that's the man that is arriving the same day. How would you like to come over for lunch? I'm lecturing tonight and the lunch will be tomorrow. So I stayed over in Dallas and I saw him at the lecture. The next day we were going to have lunch. Well, there he was and another Swami by the name of Vimalananda and myself, his secretary and a young student. So the host was serving us and after it was all over, the question came up, when the Swamis get together, what did you discuss? What did you talk about? It's always gone to know. You talk about world problems, big philosophical questions. So I said, no. He spoke about food. So the friend said, why? I said, well, the number started off the conversation. But most people who get drunk to eat, they want to talk about some other kind of philosophy, but God is food. This is Jala Yoga. Union with God through food. And he spent the whole period giving a complete presentation of all the mechanics of eating and living and chewing in with God is food. And it was all over. He bid us goodbye and got to his room. But that was the whole period of to get lived. When I told this friend, he said, holy smoke, you need to tell me that all you Swamis do? Isn't God in food too? Just as much as God is in philosophy, God is in healing, God is in everything. It is where you are at the moment, that's what you're involved with in the moment. So that's the beautiful lesson you're learning. Don't discuss something that is not pertaining to your action. Because your mind is not really relating fully. But what you're doing at that very moment that is beneficial to the body, relate all your consciousness to it at that time. In other words, if you sit down to eat, don't talk of a religion. Talk of the food, it is the mechanics of religion. If you're taking a bath, don't think of taking a walk. Think of all the impurity of your wife, you're going to go take a bath and see it in relation to religion. This is what the lesson really is. Relate to what you're doing in the framework of the spiritual nature. Then the mind is flowing much more attuned to it.
He mentioned that the man Swami made a Swami seemingly. Then Swami Saraswati worked with Gandhi for India's independence. And when we met him, he was 82 years old then. This was in 1969. We'd been invited to...
85.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, even older than I thought. 85. And that's right, he's nearly 90. Yeah. Well, he's a little bitty fellow, comes just about from my nose. Just a little dry skin like a baby. He radiates joy, you know, all over the place. You just sit there and you start getting a grin like this. You know,
just look at if I can look like him at his age, I'll be thankful.
Yes. Well, of course, he's very highly educated. He's an extremely wealthy man. And he had retired at the age of 66 to become a Swami. And so on, and then he comes over here, and we're invited to go to SMU that night to lecture to hear him. We hadn't been able to go that afternoon to the meeting. And so we got there a little bit ahead of him and waiting for him, and he comes in with a group of people, and they walk over and want you to meet Adana, you know, and so on. He comes up to Adana, and he whacks him on the back, and you're now Swami Nityananda. What does that make me? Because, when they go become a Swami, they leave their family. See, and you haven't been married much yet. They
this way, and I'm going to lose my husband. And of course, they're often about you laying it down, and you know it. And I said, what does that make me? And the first time I said that, you know, I guess I was very rude. You know, I wasn't being elated on his But then he took it upon himself to, I guess he felt sorry for me or something, you know. You're slumming, you got yachting. Calm me down. Well, I was just horrified. Sir Swati's a good name. I mean, he's Swati.
I'm sorry,
oh, goodness, he's such a wonderful little fellow. And that afternoon, see, when he had gone to this other meeting in a friend's home like this, a woman was there who, you see, that happened in October. Well, the previous May, she had become extremely ill. Couldn't find out what was the matter with her. She couldn't, well, she was in such horrible pain. They had to give her sedatives and everything. She was just, the doctors couldn't find out what in the world. And they just have to practically roll her up, you know, and because she just couldn't stand the pain. They're doing everything. And she began to have experiences like next to her bedroom was their garage they'd made into a kennel. She raised little poodles also. And she could see the, when they'd go to sleep, she'd see their little astral bodies of the ones that she kept all the time floating there to her in little pink clouds seeing settle down on her head. She didn't dare tell people these things. She started to say something, you know, and they thought she was going out of her mind. She said that committed to the institution, you know. Oh, yes. Well, anyway, see, she had never heard of any of these things. A very orthodox religion, you know. And just one thing and another happened. Well, finally, she got feeling better, and in desperation to try to understand some of this, she met an Indian man there in Dallas, Kumar, who teaches Hatha Yoga. And she talked to him. Well, he directs her to another Indian man who is an electronics engineer with LTV up there. And she meets Ashok and his wife and starts talking to them. And so then they, in turn, direct her to Adana. And so she comes and has conferences with Adana and all. So then this comes up to the time she's invited to go see the man Swami Saraswati. Well, she got over, and she's a beautiful artist, a beautiful woman. Oh, she just dresses beautifully. I mean, just very exotic, you know, but just right. And a very accomplished artist. Well, and she had a son at that time that was about 21, something like that. She's about 45. Well, she got over there, went over there with a friend of ours, Helen Howard, and she was sitting there. She began to get so nervous. She said, Helen, I feel so weird. I feel so peculiar. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know whether I'm going to be sick again or what. She said, I'm just so shaky and all. And I said, oh, you'll be all right. You know, you're just a spiritual man like this. You know, everybody gets excited. But she said it got worse and worse. And you know, nearby Helen and sit down. She's ready to sit down. She looked up and looked at the man Swami, you know, and then the next thing she knew, she was at his feet crying, Father, don't you know me? Father, don't you know me? And she's grabbing on to him. Oh, yes, daughter, I know you can hear. You can hear when I walk in the room. And it turns out that she had been his oldest child. See, he had married very young. And her son had been his son, her brother. And the mother had passed away at a very early age, and he had remarried. And she wasn't too happy in the home. The father was going off all the time to the hills to his guru, you know, the mountains rather. And she was an artist there too. And she wanted to come to America to study art. No way. He going to allow his daughter to come over to that country. So they ate meat, you know, and all the women, you know, were so, what did he say?
All gossip.
I'm gussying up themselves, you know. Oh, God, and so anyway, no.
Especially in Hollywood.
And so the young brother said, well, he wanted to go too, you know. And he'd make sure that sister didn't do things she shouldn't, and all like that. No. Mm-mm. So he took on off to his guru. Well, the girl ate some contaminated food and died very suddenly, you see. And the brother was so upset because he just adored his sister. He ran away from home, and something happened to him, and he died right away. I think within just 3 months' time, both of them were dead, or even less. And the father was just all broken up over it, you know. And right then he couldn't, but years later he followed them in consciousness. Now then, she was born over here again immediately, and before that child was even born to her, the one that had been her younger brother, she drew a picture of him as he would be as a young man. This very fitting image of that, just a perfect portrait of him. And so now then, they have this very peculiar, her illness, the doctors finally decided, was that she had to eat meat, lots and lots of meat. Oh yeah, in this country where they drank, you know, so much alcoholic beverages, and she has to have some wine with each meal.
and the
son too had developed that.
Parents don't have it.
But much less condition.
You know, son has this fin disease, they got to eat meat and drink meat for life. They can't eat vegetables, they got sick right away.
So he told them, he said he knew he was responsible for this because he had impressed this so upon their consciousness and had thwarted their desire to come to America. And that he should have done, that they had a karmic destiny. And so he said he would help them work this out, and he told them certain things they must do.
What is interesting is that now I'm no longer your father, I'm your guru. So the bond of the fathership is over. He didn't want to obey. So look at yourself all gussied up and walk around.
But he said it teasingly there. He wasn't critical there.
But he gave that his only prized possession in his life. Mm-hmm. That was his begging bowl.
His daughter, he gave her the begging bowl.
And it parted up to me, that that's part of their life is over, it all. But there's a marvelous association there of what you're talking about, the group taking over.
When you were in India, didn't you think of the people that you saw there? And you look over here, can't you see so many of these people are just direct incarnations from India? I mean, just, isn't it interesting? Have you thought of that before? You see that their last lifetime must have been in India.
We say it, but we don't really know that.
Oh, so many, it's just so obvious. The last incarnation just shortly was in you.
See, you don't gravitate to this path of the disciple relationship unless you've had it in present consciousness in previous life. You're still dealing with the guns and the glory, glory, hallelujah. But no, that's all right. But the fact that you gravitate to a mental attunement by meditation is because the Indian life or the Oriental life or Chinese life is so ingrained in your consciousness, you have to experience the association to find yourself gravitating to it. The ordinary church yankee don't fill the bill. There's something too intimate is missing. Therefore, you're seeking it. You know it because you have to experience one time. You have to experience some degree of spiritual elevation to differentiate from churchianity or the ritualism to strive for the inner values of spiritual life. Otherwise, you wouldn't be striving for it. You wouldn't even pray for it if it was not there inside your consciousness. Buddha says, you've been back here so many times, your brothers and sisters and husbands and wives, and many, many times. Yogananda said this when he was in the body. He said, this is the new end of China, you know. The way to fulfill the karma of Columbus seeking a new path to India, ending up coming to this continent and declaring it that he had arrived at India. So in that relationship, the souls from India would have to be born in this flood the world with the Caucasian body to work out some of these karmic conditions. And many of the experiences that would be so unique that we would find ourselves molding ourselves along this line. And since this country was founded on religious freedom, it was the first country to set up what is called a religious parliament of bringing together various religions to discuss religion in one area. And it was in 1896 when Vivekananda came to this country.
There's a delegate to that.
A delegate to that. And then Yogananda came to the second one.
In 1920.
From that time on, it has been this trend towards the New Age, the East-West blending of the religious life. The searching for the in-depthness of religion, apart from ritual, the actual inner science of religion. So more and more we are moving into this phase true mystic life. And many of the souls that are here that find themselves in the Caucasian body are actually oriental souls, caught up. And while we did be caught up in it, remember that in the Orient for the last 400 or 500 years, it was occupied by the British. Remember, this country was liberated from the British too. So many of those souls died with their animosity for the British, or to get even with the British. So where would they be born? With the karmic thought pattern, or to be free from British rule. We have to have unfinished desires to trust in the environment of freedom, an environment to pursue spiritual life. So we end up being born in this area of the world. It's an amazing cross-cut of souls crossing the boundary line.
An interesting thing happened over there to Dara. See, there they have a foreign guest house that at the present time accommodates about some 80 guests. And there were 13 people from South Africa there. And strangely enough, and unbeknownst to each other, I'll say it this way. Some of them had remarked to some of the other guests about me, about that North American Indian woman there. And they had remarked to each other, like I say, the different ones. Now, do I look North American Indian?
Yeah, I guess everyone will see her, the North American Indian.
Because I know of her an incarnation.
Phasing into consciousness.
So evidently they must have known me at that time. Either I was Indian and they were some other nationality that had come over, you know, or something. But I thought that was just very interesting that they had not talked it over among themselves until later, you know, and so on all, and come to find out to several unrelated people they had asked about me because they missed me. I was going over to work at the clinic one thing or another, and they thought I was ill. Perhaps or something, kept asking about, well, where's that North American Indian?
And many Europeans who wanted to go to India in the eastern countries, then their trade routes were open. You know, you always dream of faraway land and hear the great tales that come back from the east. So many of us who would be Europeans died with the desire, so where would we end up living? In some little mud hut in India, finding out what it is to be Indian. And sometime we end up living at the feet of the ashram, you know, at the feet of a master, because we want it so badly. And we don't want to leave the area. We go through all the privations of the Indian body, the Indian body, there at the ashram. But we might have been in our past life with the desire to be close to that life. And equally true, many in the Indian body or Chinese body, I don't want to break free from the occupation or control of their political life. They'll be born in an area that is free and then find themselves totally distasteful. Now you take your early plantation owners who were in control of many slaves, where do you think they could be born? They have to be born as the Panthers and the right agent in the colored people to pull the colored people out, to feel disgusted in the colored people. Because they trigger that karma. And they would be the one who would have to correct that karma. Karma is a peculiar law, but it's a balanced law. You fulfill the things that you crave, and God works it out by presenting you the situation.
Is that karma speeding up these days in some way? Is that why there are so many people in the world in population?
No new source of being manifested by God. It's the same one, but it's now getting a chance to come back faster than they were. Some are delaying their return. So they're coming back quicker into the consciousness of the activity, the consciousness. You see, by the very laws of physics, you'll see why there aren't no new souls being made by God. Let's say, take for instance, one human being, one male, one female living in the world. Now, by the act of sex, if one drop of semen under a microscope will show you how many thousands of sperm is in it. Let's say God made the very first man and woman. And within this man is the semen, where all the sperm are in. Now, and here is the one woman with the ovum. In one drop of semen, there may be thousands of sperm moving around. Yet, we know by the law of creation, one of those sperm is going to get to that ovum first. The rest will not get there. So, as long as they did not get there, they didn't have the opportunity to come into manifestation. And every time a sperm makes contact with an ovum, we have this soul force coming into manifestation. And so throughout time, all these souls have to come into manifestation at one time. Now, your scripture says a very simple statement. Come, let us make man in our own image, male and female created them. There's no mention of Adam and Eve in that statement. And God breathed into man the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And man was given the power to go out and replenish and multiply and have dominion over the universe. And that was the first creation, telling us in a strange way that this whole cosmos is already occupied by beings in different levels of awareness, in different levels of expression. Then the second creation, you see, the idea of Adam and Eve coming into manifestation. That's an entire different thing altogether. Now, we are caught up in the Adam and Eve movement. Maybe because we might have violated some of the laws in creation. We're caught up in this movement. And we try to redeem ourselves out of it. So where we are at this moment, we are like that prodigal son who went away from the father and got all the way down in the mud and now trying to get his way back. But there aren't any new souls being manufactured by God or created by God. It's simply that they're all there already in this whole cosmos. And where we find ourselves in the interplay of karma and the involvement with the density of matter, this is our particular pattern we have to work out. So if we find on the planet Earth more people appearing to be crowding in on us, not really true, because if all the sperm were to come into manifestation in one human being, the quantity that's in a human being, if all them came into manifestation, be fantastic, let alone their offspring, and the continuous amount that will continue from the laws of mathematics, there is infinite numbers.
Well, due to the ease of communication and transportation nowadays, and the vast stimuli that we have on every hand, they say that we can live easily the equivalent of 7 lifetimes in one now. You can gain so much experience. And so that's another reason why at this particular time so many souls come into physical incarnation in order to get that experience.
Well, take for instance where we came from today, from reading Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C. In the olden days, by foot travel, how much did you pay to come here? By bicycle travel, horse travel. So, lots of things are being speeded up for man.
He follows you up and you go to him.
Your God, who is
it? And then you have this just attraction.
I want to ask
you. Well, I mean,
it's God. It's God who follows you all the way through each incarnation. But then he takes the final form in one particular incarnation to act the role of the Satguru. So yank you out. It's like I threw out a fish in line. And there was quite a fish in the pond there. And I said, sooner or later the fish is going to bite on that fine. All right. But if I don't reel it in, it's going to bump around all the time. So when you start reeling it in, and put it in the basket, the final one who usually are put in the basket, okay, or to the various life forms, it's God, the Creator himself, has been guiding you. He has taken many good shapes and many gurus, many expressions of the nature of God to lift you up. And the final lift up is the one in a particular incarnation that makes you like, oh, he is my guru. But if I would say his physical form is God and my guru, no. It's God that is the guru, but it so happens that in this particular incarnation, this particular form is the final flip out. But now, if I saw him sitting in a chair, I saw not his body, but I saw the same bliss, the same inner light pass through the body in many shapes and forms. He not only appeared like an Indian monk, he appeared like a Tibetan, he appeared Jewish. And I could see myself looking at the spiritual experience, looking back in each incarnation before him, where I saw the same pure eyes, the same expression, the same love flowing back to me, and I can feel the feelings of the different nationalities than I was before. I'm trying to say, so really, here in this incarnation of this particular body, I'm confronting the same divine consciousness again, passing through. So I'm not saying that his body is the form. It so happens that the consciousness is passing through that body right then. Now, Yogananda, realizing this, This is how I come to realize why he did not want me to come to see his body, because this would not connect the thing for me, you see. And he knew this, and this is what a master would know, what the thing that would do this. That though Yogananda was in the body, and I had wonderful living experiences with him, but it was not for me, for his physical vehicle, to experience that relationship. I had to wait for it to occur through another vehicle. Now, when he went out of the body, I was pretty torn up too, you see, because I felt I really messed up and I should have gone and pushed everything in my own ego and go to him and finally make contact. But I obeyed simply because I trusted what the consciousness was telling me to do. So when Anandaswami came along, even Anandaswami's body was not the connecting link. Yet Anandaswami was the man who gave me this initiation into Swami. Yes.
I know why. Yeah.
And there I knew it was nothing, and I looked at his body and I knew that it was not. Yet he appears to love, and there was consciousness coming through, and it carried me to another level of myself. Yet, when Master Chosen walked in the room, people said they saw, I didn't see it. And I said, every time he looked at me, there was a pink light going out from him to my body. But I knew whenever he looked at me, I could see my incarnation, and I could see where I had confronted him in a previous life. There I could see myself in a little monastery looking at the abbot, who had given me the last instructions for that. That incarnation anymore, but I would not leave the abbot in one or the particular monastery. So I was living in consciousness the experiences of previous lives, those last instructions that keep the consciousness going. So in this incarnation, I was seeing the same thing now fulfilling itself. Now, I've met other masters, I met other swamis, yet I didn't have that relationship with them. So I knew this was not their role. And each one will have that experience to know which one is fulfilling the last little touch in them. It comes from inside the experience.
We should let you rest and have your tea.
Thoughts that rise in the mind that will not go away. Thoughts that mind rise in the mind that continue to dwell on, cannot be free of. What is the method to deal with interior thoughts or fears or fantasies or whatever they come up?
Connected to the body via the breath in a strange way. It can alter the mind or the thoughts in the mind by altering the way to breathe. If you are in a state of anger, you will breathe a certain way. If you're in a state of fear, you'll breathe a certain way. If you're running, you'll breathe a certain way. If you're tired, you'll breathe a certain way. So, the thoughts that come up in the mind are of two types. Those that drain you, which are negative, and those that build you up, which are positive. Now, if a thought is negative and persists, then one way is to counter it to the opposite thought and think of the opposite condition. Second way is to try to analyze the negative thoughts. Why it is there? Try to understand what a negative thought really is. It will not exist in the mind unless it has something to teach us. and maybe we don't understand deep down inside of us what that negative thought represents. So if we try to analyze it, observe it, it may even begin to show us something about ourselves. If we don't want to be involved with it totally, and we want to rise above it or transcend it, then you observe yourself breathing. As you observe yourself breathing, the incoming breath makes a certain noise in your nostrils, and the outgoing breath makes a certain noise in your nostrils. This noise or sound is the actual mantra of the breath passing through the nostrils, and it sounds like soham. These are the sounds that make soham. The incoming breath is hum, and the outgoing one is so. And soham means I am he, I am the breath. In Sanskrit, it means that I am the breath, the breath and I are one. So your sense of oneness is already identified with the breath. Now, if you observe it coming in and you mentally repeat, hum, and you wait until you feel the urge to breathe it out, it'll go by itself, don't force it, and then it flows out. And you mentally repeat so or so, and then it goes out. And then it goes out. You wait until it wants to come back in. Then you mentally repeat hum. This conscious observation shifts the wavelength of the brain from that beta level, which that thought may be persisting, into the alpha level, where you are free and you can clear and cancel the thought. This simple technique was the technique that the guru of Siddhartha, Deva Siddhartha, became the Buddha. That is known as the secret of the golden flower. That's the technique. It's one of the oldest techniques in controlling the restless mind. It was good in those days, it's still good today, because we're still the same. We are a breathing mechanism, and the consciousness comes in involved. So the only way you can know if it works, we can try it. So let's try it.
Could I just interrupt and say that the word
so hum.
Hum.
See, so, S-O-S-O, H-A-M, hum. Now, hum is coming in and so is going out. Now, the hum is usually pronounced in, like hum. And the so is usually pronounced as so. So, the hum, so. Your mind is just relating to it in terms of sounds, that's all. You don't have to literally try to fight it. Just mentally say, hum, so. Hum, so. Hum is coming in, so is going out. So, in that way, you can watch it coming in and going out, and let your mind travel on that sound frequency. Now, as I said, it's the technique that Gautama had, Siddhartha. So you can imagine, this day and age that you really want to enter deeper, mindlessly.
get a bit of some of the different, or not just different, some
period. This, for those, a couple of sand issues, one of the disciplines is not to do a pranayama exercise. This is not pranayama.
If pranayama, remember this. In Sanskrit, the word prana is both translated as breath and life. This is the mistake most of the teachers are making, even the Hatha yogis are making with the word prana, breath and life. Yama means control. So anytime you can hear a person talk about something to do with the breath, they call it pranayama. I've heard Hindus literally make a statement who are very educated and totally ignorant of what they're saying in terms of it. And they're so adamant in the point they say that that's breath control. Now breath control has nothing to do with life control. Breath control is a deliberate attempt to hold the breath in for a certain amount of time by your own volition, to push it out at a certain amount of time for a certain amount of counts, with your own volition and keep it out. And in breath control you have inhalation, pause, exhalation, pause. That means when you inhale, you count it for a certain amount of time and you retain it for a certain amount of time. You exhale it for a certain amount of time and you hold it up for a certain time. That is breath control. And that's a deliberate action on your part to hold and exclude oxygen from the mechanism. And there are myriads of techniques of that in Hatha Yoga. And they all got all kinds of fancy names. You're up to the point where you can even be called things that they don't even really have to get in the actual science. Now, the same word means life control. Now, life control, which is pranayama, has nothing to do with your consciousness trying to do anything to your breath. Your consciousness is merely an observer of the fact you are breathing. There's a vast difference between you trying to stop your breath coming in, hold it in when it's coming in, or to push it out when it's going out and holding it out. By the very nature of yourself, you're going to breathe a certain way. And you're only going to breathe a certain amount of breath from birth to death. It's already numbered by the hairs of your head. Until it changes circuitry, you're not going to run that extra hair designed by that circuitry. And equally true, until you change the circuitry of this body, you're not going to breathe an extra breath or go back an extra. It's already set up within the genes from the time you came into existence. How many breaths the system is going to take, how many food is going to eat, how much hours of sleep is going to sleep, these are all programmed in already. And you were there when this was being programmed, your spiritual force field was there. That's your spiritual nature is there, present in the programming of it. So you may not be conscious of it, you may not remember it, but it was all there at the time when you came into the mechanism. It was designed, this circuitry was designed to handle your consciousness. So, breath control has nothing to do with life control. Life control is a conscious observation of the fact that you do breathe, and not an unconscious experience. An unconscious experience happens to everybody when you breathe. Of deep breathing. And very few of us take any notice of the breath. That the breath is important in the unconscious way because it
is responsible for the changes in the body every 24 hours, every 365 days, and every 7 years, there is a physiological change brought on in the body by the breath, in a permanent conscious way. And that is the life changes in the cells. In a conscious way, there's a difference in So, when you come down to observing your thoughts, staying in the brain, and trying to correct them, you have many techniques. One, you can analyze it, explode it in your mind, see it for nothing. Two, you can try to drum it out by repeating some quantum prayer or mantra, quantum word, quantum thought. Or you can synchronize your consciousness with the incoming outgoing breath, which flushes it out. I've found over the years, it's easy to flush it out because it goes up too fast. Okay? The thought is played out. It shifts the brain from the beta wave to the alpha wave. And with the new machines, your alpha machine that they're making, it can be verified a whole lot quicker that you can shift these levels and the thought to go up. So, if you watch the breath and don't force your mind, you're just watching it coming in. Watching is a very important thing because it teaches you patience. It teaches you self-observation. It teaches you discernment. It teaches you discrimination. This is an interesting part of watching the breath. At the same time, it calms the body down, it cools it down, and it clears the wavelength by watching, by observing. Now that's the very first part of a meditation, self-observation. The very first true experience of meditation, self-observation. To observe yourself in this flow of vital movement of energy. Life is energy, and consciousness is involved in observation. So you are not breaking any rule or imposing any rule on your body. You're merely observing how this mechanism flows, and you're synchronizing with the sun that it's making. So it's very, very scientific and very safe. And in fact, it will clear up a whole host of mental neuroses that other techniques can do. So, one try it now. But was that a good salesman trip? That's been a good class
trip.
Why is God identified so much with the breath?
The words are very, very synonymous in their writings. God breathed into man the breath of life. See, these are three words. He didn't say God breathed into man breath. He said God breathed into man life. States are very important. Very scientific. Breath of life. The breath of life into man. God breathed the breath of life into man. And man became a living soul. Now, you can't have life energy. That's why they use the word pranayama. The prana is the very first word that has two meanings in Sanskrit, life and breath. It's translated both ways. The pran is the vital life principle, found within the principle of breathing. Now, one can say, what is it we breathe in that keeps us alive? Oxygen?
Yeah.
Well, oxygen don't keep a dead man alive. Yet, how would Jesus Christ bring back Lazarus to life? See? Yet, oxygen is in the air, and we need the oxygen to live, right? There is something in the oxygen that we haven't really understood as yet. But it requires breathing to utilize oxygen. So the two are interrelated. But it's not the oxygen that's really keeping us alive. The vital current, that is the subatomic energy, which is the life force, the vital principle, that is locked up in the atom itself, in that oxygen atom, that is giving us life. Now, we take in oxygen, which flushes this system from its toxins, and we give up carbon dioxide. Now, carbon dioxide is very detrimental to our system. You see? Now, but the extra atoms of oxygen, not the extra oxygen that we take in when we breathe in, because we don't use all the atoms of oxygen right away. Some come in and some go in and actually flush the body out from its carbon dioxide state. And there are a few that remain that nourish the centers, which are the endocrine system and the brain. This extra oxygen, this extra atom that are locked up in the oxygen, they activate or rejuvenate the spinal centers. When we are conscious, because only the human brain can trigger it on a conscious level. Now, in the unconscious level, those added oxygen atoms will require 7 physical years to make changes in the cells. So every 7 years, your body changes. And after a while, your body repeats the pattern every 7 years. Now, in the awareness of the human being, because breath, the act of breathing, or the incoming pumping of the lungs, is interrelated with the essence of the oxygen and the atoms in it, seems to infuse life, then there's consciousness. Now, the dead man don't breathe, therefore the dead man is not conscious, right? There is no breathing and he's not conscious, but there is no life going in too at the same time. There are no atoms of the oxygen permeating his mechanism. Yet when the Master Jesus wants to activate this dead man, he's got to put some kind of a power there that has nothing to do with the oxygen. His own conscious force field, his own ability to synchronize with that atom. Now, if a man is dead, he may have some blood in the body. We really don't live by breathing. Highly evolved yogis don't breathe. So it proves one thing, breath is not the means by which we live in. We live by vital life power. But this vital life power is passing through oxygen and is utilized in an unconscious way. When we are conscious, then we don't have the need of breathing. We are drawing energy directly by photosynthesis. Our body is nourished by this. Man does not live by bread alone. Man does not live by indirect forms of energy alone, which is like oxygen and food. But by every word, that means the vibratory rate of the creative intelligence passing through his body, which is within the temple of Lambrata, which is called another God in man. Man is really living from there. So, if he is conscious, and that is where the brain has to focus now, on what it's observing, the function of breathing is a secondary relationship. And if he's conscious of this relationship, he can play this track in the mind from being stuck in the rut of unnecessary thought patterns or unnecessary ideas that seem to persist and don't get out. Really, the mind would not need to breathe if the body is not functioning. But because the body functions by taking oxygen, this is an indirect way for the energy to come in. So let me say, breathing and life seem to be related and they're involved with God. It's true. But it's always the word breath of life. The breathing involves the atomic energy of the life principle passing through us. Now, the breath carries oxygen of a specific quantum, and the life is lightran. Now, oxygen is an atomic principle utilizing proton and electron. Yet the mere oxygen is insufficient to keep it alive. It's the subatomic functions which are the lightran. That's a different function of those very same electrons now working within us that sustains us and keeps us alive. We have electron, lightran, and we have proton. Now, we couldn't live if we didn't have electrons to work on this chemical body in the form of the oxygen. And if the subatomic function of the atom never permeates us, we couldn't begin to live without the oxygen if we didn't have the electron. Now, but we are not sustained merely by the electron, we are sustained by the proton. This is the thought, the very idea. That's another subatomic energy that is holding us together. So man is an idea in God. We are still a thought of God. God holds us up in a thought. When we come to the final realization, we are all thoughts. The final realization is that this consciousness of divine intelligence is projecting us out of himself by thought. And it's a very, very fine particle of matter. But it has the quality of calling it thought or creative intelligence. So that thought power, which is a super subatomic field now, very, very fine, is below even the subatomic one in which we have the life form. And then from the life form you have the coarse electron that is visible and can be observed. Now, the coarse electron that is observed is an electron that is moving to group itself by magnetic action and is not motivated by its own self-propulsion because it doesn't have a desire and nature locked up in it. Whereas in the subatomic energy, where it comes into the life form, it is self-propelled by its own inherent nature. Therefore, it seems to possess what is called desire, because the brain can trigger it. The brain can fire it. The brain has an ability to fire it because the brain does generate desire. And desire is sensory stimuli in terms of electromagnetic reaction. So the brain does trigger the subatomic forms of the oxygen. And that is the life form. And it will group itself and mold itself. But inasmuch as it will do that, again, we come to the thought run. The thought run is the actual force field that triggers the life form. And the thought run now seems to have a volition of its own, seems to have a will of its own, a pattern of its own. Aside from being capable of self-propulsion, it seems to follow a definite plan of its own. And this plan is to maintain certain geometrical shapes and cause these geometrical shapes to group themselves continuously all the time. So this is the same way that God has a plan, God has a purpose. Everything is following His divine plan. Simply because these super subatomic forms are adhering to some prearranged magnetic frequency and does not deviate from it. This is why they say, all the masters say that God's creation is perfect. God is already here as thought of life and breath. But when we look at Him as thought of life and breath, we have to look at Him on the three levels of the atomic function. The first level, we're looking at the thought form, which is the super minute form. The next level is life form, which is the sub. And then we have to look at Him as electron, which is final creation, the mechanical movement of breath. See, this mechanical movement of breath is some way to relate to Him mechanically. Yet within that mechanical breath of oxygen, He is the life. And within that life, He is the thought principle, or the mold, or archetypal pattern. So you have the same thing Jung is calling the archetypal pattern, the thought principle. So there is no real conflict, but a sort of coordination between a term breath and a term life. They are not in conflict, they are in coordination.
Is God oxygen?
Well, what else do you think He would be? An aspect of His nature? Well, let me show you something. Why? Remember, they say God is spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Spirit is energy. Now, oxygen is what? A gas, right? Now, what do you term a gas when you explode the atomic charge? Energy. So energy in a state of motion in three levels. That is purpose, preservative, and formative. Purpose would be thought. Preservative or continuative would be life. And formative would be electron or shape design. The oxygen molecule itself. Now, anytime we refer to the mind in mystic writings, we always refer to it as water. We use the word wave. The waves of the mind. There is never any mention of it being symbolically used except in the waves of water. Now, water is a composite of hydrogen and oxygen. Now, if you freeze water, it's still composed of hydrogen and oxygen, yet it's called ice. If you cook water, it still has hydrogen and oxygen, but you call it steam. And if you let it come back down by its own force field of gravity after it goes up into the air in the form of steam and vapor, it will come down back as rain, which is hydrogen and oxygen water. Now, from the day this whole universe was created, not one drop of water has been added, not one drop of water has been taken away, and therefore no more oxygen, no more hydrogen has been added to the universe. It's all there at the same time.
But oxygen is like a secondary force.
It is the physical expression of the life energy, which is the subatomic function of the atom, which is, again, the physical expression of the thought form, which is the God principle itself, the creative intelligence. This is a Trinity universe based upon thought, life, form. The thought itself is the creative intelligence. This is the thought form. The life itself is the process that infuses everything to give it a living quality. And the form is what we see as the end product. We don't go any further than the end product, because as soon as we pop open the oxygen atom, that's it. Now, the extra atom, only a human body is capable of transmuting it. There's no other body that can transmute it back from electron to electron to proton. Simply because the creative intelligence chose this particular flesh form for that transmuting principle. You see, of all the flesh forms, you only see life, animal, and man. There's plant life, there's mineral life, but none of those other two can do the transformation of electron to electron to proton. Man is the only thing that can do it, because man is an expression of the audible life current. The verbal life current that is audible and is passing through us, and is interlocked with the formation of the oxygen. And through the process of breathing, we trap the subatomic principles in it and absorb them and work with them. Now, you understand anything about laughing gas? Laughing is an expression of mind, right? Gas is a gas of some kind of a substance that you have to inhale that will trigger the condition of an attitude of laughing. Now, what is the chemical properties of laughing gas?
Nitric oxide.
But you see, you have an oxide. It's nitrogen and oxygen. But it still has to use the oxygen base for it to go into this mechanism to trigger a change in awareness of the behavior pattern of that individual. So we're dealing with a gas principle. Now, we can't get all strung out and take God with somebody sitting on a throne. Now, are you familiar with the properties of hyperventilation? Right, getting more oxygen, but what are some of the symptoms of hyperventilation? Changing of the consciousness. And there are certain levels of hyperventilation where patterns of thinking are altered. Certain thought patterns are actually altered by hyperventilation. That is only